from WBUR Boston and NPR. I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. For years, the word drone called to mind images of the lethal military-grade Predator drone flying high over foreign skies. But there is another, different swarm of drones eager to take to American skies to join the civil and commercial workforce at home, surveying crops and construction sites, working for law enforcement and the entertainment industry, and yes, maybe one day delivering your books or burritos. That fleet is operating in a kind of wild west of legal ambiguity as the FAA decides how to cope with the future of drone-filled skies. This hour on Point, drones in America. Later in this hour, we will hear from former White House Special Advisor and security big thinker Richard Clark about American drone policy and legality abroad and his own fictional take on where things could go there. But first, let's bring it home. Amazon's vision? Oh, you'll have delivery all over the place. Here's a little bit of a video produced by Amazon just last year, promotional video. Amazon Prime Air, deliver your item in 30 minutes by drone, as an Amazon drone here buzzes through the sky over fields and rivers before dropping off a package at the customer's front door. Simple as that, plop, and off it goes. That is maybe the welcome vision of a drone future. One little facet of it is another potential facet already with us. Earlier this month, the FAA revealed that a 50-passenger U.S. Airways flight from Charlotte, North Carolina to Tallahassee, Florida, had a near miss, very near, with a drone back in March of this year. Here's CNN's Renee Marsh reporting.
A near nightmare in the sky. A passenger plane nearly crashes into a camouflage drone flying at 2,300 feet, well above the typical altitude for a private drone. The incident in the Tallahassee skies involved a U.S. Airways Express jet flying near the airport.
We're talking about drones at home. They're a new miss in American skies. Joining me now from Chicago is Jack Nickas, aviation reporter for The Wall Street Journal, covering drones, the FAA, the airline industry. He broke the story of the near collision of that drone and 50-passenger U.S. Airways jet in Florida. Jack Nickas, welcome to On Point.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for having me.
Can we just take that on first? How big was this drone? What was it doing up that high, 2,300 feet in the air? And are there many up there, Nick?
It's a very good question, and something we're still trying to figure out. The FAA is not revealing much more about this incident other than what they told me earlier this month and what they've said in a rather brief statement. But, you know, basically what we do know is sort of what the CNN correspondent said, and there was a drone at 2,300 feet, and the pilot, according to the FAA, told air traffic control that they were so close that they thought they had hit. Now, what's unclear is what sort of drone this was. Clearly, the FAA said this is not a sort of quadcopter, which is what we'll probably talk about later in a more conventional type of drone that's doing commercial use, but more of a model aircraft and actually a model F-4. So there's speculation about what this was doing, whether it was a model aircraft, whether it was a military exercise, et cetera. Right now, we don't know, but at the very least, this was an extraordinary incident because the FAA regulations require aircraft airborne to remain at least several miles laterally apart and at least a mile apart vertically. So this was clearly a near miss.
Jack Nickas broke that story in the Wall Street Journal, and we're still trying to figure out exactly what happened there. The pilot has said he thought he actually hit whatever that was way up high. Jack, here we are. We've got an industry that clearly is looking to grow and maybe even boom in this country, and a kind of wild west when it comes to what regulations are now, what law is here. FAA is still trying to figure out how to integrate this into America's skies. Where does that all stand? The FAA's consideration of the future of drones, our regulation and laws, and what's going on with the industry itself, Jack? Jack, excuse me.
Yeah, we are at a really fascinating point right now. And so what we have is a technology that's moving very quickly in a government that is struggling to keep up. Drones have taken to the U.S. skies in droves in recent years, and as you said, you know, especially in the past several months, to film movies, monitor crops, inspect roofs, and even report on the news. Now, meanwhile, the Federal Aviation Administration has said any commercial use of a drone requires the agency's explicit approval. But the FAA has only authorized two commercial drones, and both for use off the coast of Alaska. So that means many people here in the U.S., the continental U.S., are violating FAA policy, in effect, with their drones. And the FAA is really not able to do much about the stampede of drone use. And the agency has sent cease and desist letters and has brought civil penalties against two drone users, albeit both for operating recklessly. But many of these users, including companies that are based around the use of drones, have not even heard from the FAA. And whether that's because of an issue of resources, logistics, or choice by the federal government, it's unclear.
We have the most densely packed skies with airplanes, aircraft, in the world. What's the vision of how drones might fit in up there?
Well, that is also something the FAA is trying to figure out, and hopefully before industry and before this kind of happens without their say. But, you know, there are a whole slew of theories, and right now what we're seeing is, you know, low altitude use of drones, these smaller drones that really aren't operating in the airspace of commercial aircraft and passenger aircraft. But we already today have the technology for some of the larger drones that have been used by the military to be used here in America. Now, unarmed, of course, so don't be alarmed, but already the Customs and Border Patrol are using the Predator drones, which are the kind of famous drones used abroad by the U.S. military, to monitor our borders. And also, you know, at a drone conference last week, one company displayed a new technology that allows a helicopter to autonomously land, you know, basically choose its own landing spot using LIDAR technology, which is sort of laser sensors. And he says that this means pretty soon we're going to have unmanned passenger aircraft.
Unmanned passenger aircraft, and I can only imagine they would be thinking cargo as well.
Absolutely. You know, that's the way this is heading. I mean, drones represent, for companies and U.S. businesses out there, a low-cost alternative, much more efficient and much more effective in many cases than, manned pilots.
If we haven't got the regulation worked out, what kind of break does that put on all of this development? And what about U.S. competitiveness in the drone sector internationally?
Well, that's a key question. And what we're seeing right now is, you know, drone use is really, it's of course taking off here in the U.S., but it's taking off in some ways even more abroad and with the, you know, at least tacit approval of the governments abroad. You know, in Australia has been lauded for being rather accommodating to drones, the U.K. in some cases. There are a lot of accusations from the drone industry here in the U.S. that the FAA and the federal government is stifling innovation and basically holding us back from what can be, you know, a big booming part of the economy. So it's going to be a key question, but the FAA is trying to move as fast as it can to issue a rule for small drones in November, but already that rule is several years late. And when they propose that rule later this year, hopefully, we will still have another year or two of rulemaking process and comments and all that before it's finalized.
Meanwhile, we've got a federal official calling it the Wild West out there, up there. We've got a drone operator fined after almost hitting a pedestrian in New York City. Jack Nickus covers it all for the Wall Street Journal. He joined us from Chicago. Jack, thanks very much for your insight.
Thank you, Tom.
Vijay Kumar joins us right now from Philadelphia, roboticist and UPS Foundation professor at the University of Pennsylvania School of Engineering and Applied Sciences. He's a former assistant director of robotics and cyber physical systems at the White House Office of Science and Technology Policy. Delivered a keynote address at last week's Unmanned Systems North America Conference in Orlando, Florida. Vijay Kumar, welcome to On Point.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for having me on your show.
There's so many layers of this. We're hearing about potentially passengers being flown around in drones, cargo way up there in drones. At a lower level, we've heard Amazon's and many others' plans for drones. You think a lot about quite small drones and swarms of drones. To do what kind of thing, Vijay?
Well, first of all, I should say, to add to Jack's comments, whether you talk about small drones or large aircrafts, the major problems are what I call the last 50 meters or the last 100 yards, where you really have to approach a landing strip or take off, low to the ground. And oftentimes you might not have GPS, particularly for the small robots that we build. If you've ever driven a car in, you know, Boston, New York, or Philadelphia, where I live, GPS fails you at the time that you need it the most. And so what we work on are these really small robots equipped with sensors that can navigate in the absence of GPS. And of course, if you have GPS, that's great because you can incorporate that information to index your map to a geo-reference coordinate system.
And if I've got a swarm of very, very small drones, what might I do with it?
Well, the thing that we're really excited about is really using it for first response. I mean, there have been a series of disasters going back to last summer where we had the wildfires. in Arizona 2 years ago, 3 years ago, we had the earthquake and the tsunami in Japan. Imagine if you had really small robots that could fly through really constrained environments, gathering information and providing valuable feedback to first responders. You wouldn't put your bravest and your smartest people in harm's way. So you're talking about putting them
into schools if there's a shooting incident, for example, to map out what's going on in the hallways or have them fly over a mudslide like we saw in Oregon not so long ago.
For example, if you have an active shooter in a building, it would take seconds literally for swarms of small UAVs to fly through the buildings and locate the person, and that could make the difference between life and death.
Landslide in Washington, I should say. Are you waiting on FAA rulings as well for that kind of application, Vijay?
Well, the FAA is in a hard position now. I mean, their goal is to provide the safest and most efficient aviation system in the world, and we have to respect the care and deliberation with which they're approaching this. So a lot of what we do is really indoors, where the FAA doesn't really worry about things that are constrained by a ceiling. But we do worry about going from outdoors to indoors, where we worry about what FAA wants us to do. And we think about we're creating artificial ceilings that sort of prevent the FAA from getting all worried about how we're doing our experiments.
Vijay Kumar, please stand by in Philadelphia. We're talking about drones in American skies, even inside American structures, the future of drones in this country. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about drones in American skies for all kinds of tasks. Where that stands, where that's heading, is the sound of a swarm of 20 nano drones from Vijay's lab at the University of Pennsylvania. Imagine suddenly coming on that in your school hallway. It could be in your future. You can join the conversation this hour. Do you picture swarms of drones up there doing all kinds of things? Is that a welcome vision? Is it exciting or off-putting? Of course, it's in popular imagination in all kinds of ways because of drones' lethal application abroad. 24 is back on Fox TV, and in the latest, well, drones are being taken over, terrorists gaining control. Here, Kiefer Sutherland, Jack Bauer, and a hacker, Adrian Cross, played by Michael Wincott, talk about that threat.
Why are you here? I thought we were done.
He's designed an override device that can take control of as many as 10 U.S. drones. That device is now in the hands of a known terrorist. The new drones carry 6 Hellfire missiles. You have any idea what that could do to a city like London?
Wouldn't be an issue if your country hadn't decided to fill the skies with unmanned, heavily armed aircraft, would it?
Yes, and we have done that. We'll talk later in this hour with Richard Clark, who was very big in White House national security, counterterrorism, and more. He's out with a new fictional look at drones, but we'll also look at the latest interpretation of law over American drone use abroad. But right now, we're looking domestic. I want to bring in, if I may, somebody straight out of the business. Christian Sands joins us from San Francisco, CEO and founder of Skycatch. It's a company that provides data and information for clients through imaging drones. Chris Sands, thanks very much for being with us.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for having me.
So what does it mean to capture images for companies via drone, and are you inhibited in that by where our regulations stand now?
So the way we operate, we basically sell the equipment to companies, so they operate themselves, which makes this completely legal in terms of you operating your own drones. What we focus on is giving companies the ability to collect data so that they can manage, they can provide security. And what we do specifically that's very unique is create a robotic ground robot that basically allows for the UAV or the drone to land on it completely autonomously, swap the batteries, and send the data to the cloud.
So unmanned aerial vehicle, we've heard about applications like this being used for railways to track their, you know, fly along and make sure the track is good, the bridges are good, for oil refineries to look at smokestacks and other equipment that's hard to get to. What kind of applications are you selling for, Chris?
Yeah, so right now we're focusing, the array of different types of applications are pretty big. We are focusing on the ones that we feel are the most needed. At this point, when I started the business about a year and a half ago, I was basically trying to prove to see if this was a real a real thing or if there was a real chance I can turn this into a real business. And so I spent a lot of time just going around and investigating, going to ports, going to mining companies, going to construction sites. And I wanted to start with a problem and then work myself backwards to see if actually that existed. And what happened was I ended up at several construction sites, and I noticed that everybody was carrying an iPhone and taking photos all the time. So there was definitely a need for taking imagery. And at one point, I basically was stopped by one of these guys as I was flying around and just showing one of the drones. And one guy asked me, hey, can you fly and take a photo of the panels on the side of the building? And I volunteered to do this for free. And then he asked, can you do that again, maybe in like an hour? And I basically asked, you know, why do you need this image? You can probably take an iPhone photo really quickly. And so, well, I'm in the office and I need to send this really quickly. And then long story short, I spent 2 weeks at a construction site embedded, doing free work and basically getting requests from everybody, top-down imagery on the sand piles. And what I learned was that at any given point when people are walking around, there's at least 100 to 200 questions people are asking about what's going on the ground. And this basically gives them really quick visibility that can be spread out via email or whatever other vehicle they use, whether it's social media or their own internal tools, to broadcast what's going on the ground. And basically, that's what gave birth to SkyCatch. At the end of the 2 weeks, I basically said, I can really keep up with all the demand, and I'm going to build something that's basically going to replace me, and it's going to give you the ability to collect data at scale. So you don't need pilots anymore. You just collect data, and we'll give you the data, and you can analyze the data. And that's what we're doing today with construction sites, construction companies, and also in mining as well. Mining is basically mostly about imaging and less about security. A lot of the things that we do is collect a lot of data and we post-process it. We analyze it and look for things such as cracks on open pit benches so that we can prevent landslides. We look for air quality checks in different areas of the mine because, you know, all of this material can be very dangerous for people's eyes. So we do all sorts of things like that to keep people safe. We also do stockpile surveying. So you don't have to send a surveyor on top of a stockpile that's extremely dangerous. Instead, you just send a robot, and it basically sends you the data back.
Chris Sands, we're getting a sense of the breadth there just in your work. I mean, get the drones up there with cameras and with battery packs that can let them go. There's so many things they can do. We saw an Oscar go at the Academy Awards, just recently here, for filming of a feature film that was done by drone. Applications all over the place, from swarms, maybe even inside buildings, to cargo and passengers, hypothetically, way up high in among manned aircraft. We've got listeners with lots of questions about this, and we've got big questions about where regulation stands, what it will permit, what it may not. Let me go to Neil in Cameron, Wisconsin. Neil, you're on the air. Thanks for calling.
Yeah, Tom. I am a full-sized pilot, fly private business jets around the country,
okay.
And I see the drones, especially the quadcopter, hexcopters that you know a lot of people are buying today off the internet stuff. I see this being a huge problem. Like when we approach airports, and very concerned about one of those things coming through my windshield. The flip side of it is I also fly radio control aircraft for a hobby, and so I'm also concerned about overregulation and maybe my hobby going away or being so regulated that I can't have access to my products anymore.
Neil, you're a pilot then on both sides of this equation. Can you imagine a future where with supercomputers and good programming, we can have all kinds of drones in the sky plus all kinds of manned aircraft traffic in the sky, and everything works out fine?
I see that being a real problem. I have a hard time imagining that. And I also have a hard time, I guess a litmus test for me would be, would I put my family on an airliner that is manned by a computer? And certainly at this point, I would say no, because there's been occasions where we've had an issue in the aircraft that isn't caused by something that would illuminate a warning in the cockpit, but we had to make a decision about what we're going to do with a particular situation.
Yeah, there's a pilot speaking, and maybe that's the furthest down the road, but it's out there. There's a lot out there on the drawing board, or certainly on people's minds. Neil, I appreciate your call. One more right here from Justin in Worcester, Massachusetts. Justin, you're on.
Hi, Tom. My sentiments with the last caller on a number of ways. Either way, when considering drones, this has to be a regulated process. It has to be a democratic process. It has to be a transparent process. And my real fear is not so much with the private use, although that should be regulated as well and highly regulated at that, but on the government side. There was a survey that went out about a year and a half, 2 years ago, which asked the public, what would you be in favor of for drone use? Would you be in favor of it, tracking people who are speeding on the highway? Or would you be in favor of it, monitoring the border, the United States-Mexico border? Everyone, the majority of people said, no, absolutely not. Do not go after speeders with drones. And I totally agree with that. It's infringing upon our way of life. We don't like change.
And yet a lot of police departments are looking to buy or have already bought drones. And this is an interesting circumstance where the United States might say, we're worried about this, but we're not the only country working on it. Chinese are making drones as well. I suppose they could fill the air with drones, or at least set a new standard for what gets done from the sky, whether or not the U.S. does it. We've got it, Justin. One more right here, if I may. Mark in Harvard, Massachusetts. Mark, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. I've got two comments. My take on, and let me tell you where I'm coming from first. About 3 years ago, I realized how, what the future was for drones. They're coming. They're going to be commercial. They're going to be, practically used by people for civilian commercial uses. It's already being done overseas in other countries where the regulatory environment is permitting it, and it's growing fast. Now, having said that, a lot of people, a number of people have said the FAA is doing the best they can. My opinion is that they are not, that they are dragging their heels. They could have said, 2 years ago, 3 years ago, when they had their first deadline, you can do this in this underneath the same regulations that you currently do RC aircraft, and you can do it commercially.
Mark, what's the problem with going a little bit slow here, Mark? I mean, we don't want too much danger in the sky. You heard our pilot call in and say he'd be worried about running into drones up there. What's the problem with taking our time with these new regs?
Stifling innovation, stifling the business. It's happening overseas. I mean, I tried to get a dealership started, to sell these things. I can't sell them. I mean, I can, but if someone would buy them, but nobody wants to buy them
because of the questions about regulation. I appreciate your call, Mark. Vijay Kumar in Philadelphia. You said we're at a tipping point in terms of drone technology. What about in terms of regulation and getting drones up there in the sky? Are we stalling? Are we moving ahead? Do you picture a time where Americans are quite accustomed to see drones zipping around at all kinds of different altitudes?
I think they're definitely really important questions that are being raised by the callers. I think there are three questions. One of safety, which we've touched on, is an issue of privacy because that's not necessarily having to do with drones, but the fact that you have cameras and the price for getting data, as Chris just mentioned, it's really easy to put cameras on drones and get data.
And have it fly over your backyard, by your bedroom window, whatever.
Exactly. And the question of who owns the airspace above my house is not quite clear, right? Mm-hmm. But, my question is, I would ask the callers, are we doing everything that we can as a nation in terms of developing and deploying the best possible technology to keep first responders safe? If we have an opportunity to increase the yield per square foot for crops by a factor of 10, if we have the opportunity to decrease the water consumption by an order of magnitude, shouldn't we be doing everything possible to do that? And again, you have to understand the FAA's position on this, and it's up to us, I think, to engage the government. I think democracy is not a spectator sport. You have to be involved in the policy making, and you have to work with the government to make this possible. This is, I think, an unprecedented change in avionics, and I think it's up to people like us to actually engage in these discussions and to make this transition possible.
Vijay, do we have the computer power to mount air traffic control that is smart enough to account for all the piloted aircraft that are up there, plus layer on layer of autonomous or, you know, drones run by hobbyists and small business people out of their backyards or off the roof of their outfit. Can we have all this going on and keep track of it so that we're not, you know, bonging pedestrians on the head in New York or getting in the way of passenger airliners coming into Tallahassee?
I think the air traffic control problem, which is hard, but actually is the easiest problem to deal with. And I think we have the compute power, we have the technology to do it. I think the harder problem is, to regulate individual aircrafts. The barrier to entry to build one of these has now gone significantly down. And how do you regulate it and say, hey, operator A is safe and operator B is not safe? I think that's a tricky question. I think the second question you alluded to, people landing autonomously. In the case of an emergency, would you rather have a Captain Sullenberger at the cockpit or a robotic aircraft? And I think robots and in general AI software is incredibly poor at making decisions compared to humans in such critical situations. And I think one of your callers alluded to that too. I think that would be my bigger concern.
And yet robot is the word you prefer here, I think, Vijay, over drone, because you're working with and imagining a future of smart airborne unmanned vehicles.
Yeah, I think drones have a negative connotation. We refer to military aircrafts as drones, where in fact there are crews of 10 to 20 people that operate each aircraft, and to call them drones would be an insult to their intelligence, I think.
We heard Jeff Bezos talk about Amazon delivery, and it brings to mind, a picture of an urban environment where you'd have street traffic, and then above street traffic, you have drone traffic, and it might be as thick as street traffic someday. Does that sound crazy to you or like a real possibility, Vijay?
I think it's a real possibility, and you have to look at what Google is trying to do with their autonomous cars. In some sense, driving at 55 miles an hour in urban environments is a lot harder than flying at 55 miles an hour, 100 or 200 feet above the ground. But like I said, it's the last 100 yards or 50 meters or whatever you want to use as a length scale, which is the most challenging because you're close to the ground. You have to worry about things that you don't have to worry about in midair. You have to worry about collisions. You have to worry about safety, and you have to worry about landing carefully. And the Google car has its own version of that problem, and the Amazon drone has its own version of that problem. But I think these two technologies, the ground-based autonomous vehicles and then the air-based flying vehicles, so these two technologies I think will converge. And the kinds of sensors, the kind of compute power that make one possible will also make the other possible.
Chris Sands, do you see this future coming? Is it going to be there, drone-filled skies in America, or will we get caught up in a regulatory swamp and it will not happen?
Yeah, absolutely. I think I want to echo Vijay's comment about the hardest, most complicated part is regulating. And I think that's where I don't think the FAA is stalling on us or just trying to make it slower. It's just extremely complicated working with law enforcement all over the country and feds and everybody who are actually going to be the ones going out and arresting people and taking them to court. Imagine not being able to prove that this person actually was breaking the law. It's going to be really complicated for cities. It's going to be very expensive. They're going to have to hire more people, you name it.
But here it comes. Chris Christian Sands is CEO and founder of Skycatch out of San Francisco. They do remote imaging via drone for their clients. Chris Sands, thanks very much for joining us today.
Thank you.
Vijay Kumar at the University of Pennsylvania School of Engineering and Applied Sciences. Vijay, Professor Kumar, thank you very much for your insights. Good luck with your research.
Thanks very much, Tom.
Listeners, when we come back, Richard Clark joins us. His new book is Sting of the Drone. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. Yesterday, the Justice Department announced it will release its 2011 legal memorandum justifying the killing of American terror suspects abroad, including the killing of U.S. citizen Anwar al-Awlaki by a CIA drone in Yemen. It may be weeks before the actual memo is released. It's a reminder of how widespread and controversial the U.S. use of drone warfare has been. Former special advisor to President Bush, Richard Clark, takes a fictional look at that world of drones in his new novel, Sting of the Drone. Richard Clark served as White House National Coordinator for Security, Infrastructure Protection, and Counterterrorism from 1998 to 2001, and as Special Advisor to the President on Cybersecurity from 2001 to 2003. His new novel is Sting of the Drone. Richard Clark, welcome to On Point.
Tom, it's good to be with you again.
Can we go to reality first? We've got word coming out. We want to hear about your story. But here's word that we're going to hear more about the legal memorandum that made possible, gave legal permission for these attacks to take place. What do you expect we'll learn when we finally get to read the rationale that's been behind attacks, many attacks, though not most on Americans, in these recent years, Richard?
Well, the opinion that's going to be released affects the attack on one American in Yemen who was targeted. Two other Americans have also been killed in the drone program. So three Americans have been killed. I suspect it'll be very similar to what the White House has said in the past. And it goes like this. By analogy, if an American during World War II had gone to Germany, put on the Nazi uniform, gone to the front line and tried to kill American forces, when we saw that person, if we knew he was an American, we wouldn't arrest him and bring him back before a jury. And what they will say is that this American, who was born in New Mexico, went overseas, became part of Al-Qaeda, tried to kill Americans, taught people how to kill Americans, instructed people to launch attacks, and was therefore, like any other Al-Qaeda leader, subject to attack. That's the rationale. You can quibble with that, you can argue with that, but that's, I think, what they're going to say.
The war on terror has ambiguous boundaries and edges. That definition of someone as a terrorist who doesn't deserve a trial by jury or judge or formal charges and all the rest can get murky. How do you feel about it as someone who's been a practitioner in the midst of American security work?
Well, when I was in the White House for all 8 years of the Clinton administration, I tried every time when we had a terrorist abroad to arrest them and bring them back and give them their Miranda rights and give them a lawyer and give them a trial by jury. And we did that a lot. We convicted every one of them. So if you can do that, I think that is absolutely the way to go. If someone is in the mountains of Yemen and you can't get the Yemeni government to go up there and get him, you can't reasonably drop in special forces and arrest him, then you ask yourself, what can I do to stop him from trying to blow up American airplanes? And there are very few arrows in our quiver, and this is the whole point I try to get out with the novel, Sting of the Drone, which is from the counterterrorist's perspective, he's got the weight of the world on his shoulders. He's trying to stop attacks on Americans. He'll get very criticized if he fails at that. And yet, when he looks in his quiver, the one thing that seems to work most of the time is a drone strike. It doesn't work all the time. Recently, we blew up a wedding in Yemen. Mm-hmm. You do that, you make enemies of all sorts of people who weren't your enemies before. You make enemies of whole tribes filled with people. We've now killed over 2,500 people in five countries using drones. And maybe, just possibly, we've used that tool more than it was originally intended and more than we should have, and maybe that tool has become counterproductive.
Former White House Security Advisor Richard Clark is with us. His new novel is Sting of the Drone. I want to come to that story. We've got questions for you that may take us there. Ray in Milwaukee, you're on the air with Richard Clark. Thanks for calling, Ray.
Hi, Tom. My question, I'm very concerned about this, and I find it un-American what we're doing with these drones. And let's say North Korea develops a drone in the next year, or China, or some other country, maybe Russia, maybe a Russian drone. Maybe that would be a better way to look at this. Let's say there's a Russian drone, and they're going to take out some of the operatives here in America that are funding what's going on in Ukraine. Would that be legal in America's eyes since we have been doing this around the world, or would we consider that strike illegal?
I can imagine all kinds of uproar if it was a Russian drone in American skies. Richard Clark, what do you say?
Well, believe it or not, that's kind of one of the issues in the novel.
Yeah.
What happens if people attack us? What if the people who we are attacking with drones come to the United States and attack the drone pilots? You know, the drone pilots are not in Afghanistan. They're 10,000 miles away. Many of them are in an Air Force base in Las Vegas. And so they fly their eight-hour shift over Pakistan, perhaps killing people. And then they step out of their darkened, air-conditioned room into a bright Las Vegas day and get in their car and drive home. It's a very different way of war.
In your novel story, and we'll look at this international reality that Ray raises from Milwaukee, you've got the U.S. drone program there, as you describe, a kill committee deciding who will be on its hit list. But you've also got pushback, in your case, not as much from nations, but certainly from organized crime and certainly from Al-Qaeda, who sort of point out, well, more than one can play this game.
So Al-Qaeda has tried to push back. Iran has tried to push back on the drone program. And what I try to do is extrapolate what they've already done, turn it into a thriller that people will enjoy reading, but at the same time raise all of these issues, because it's not going to stay a one-sided game. It can't. The technology is out there. 40 countries, 40 nations, air forces, have drones. Three countries, I think, have used them to kill people, including the United States. This is just going to get more and more the way of war in the future.
The United States has used drones to kill. Who else?
I think Israel has, and I think Russia has, but much, much smaller numbers. When I use the number 2,500 American fatalities, or fatalities America has in, committed in five countries, I think that's the floor. That's the lowest estimate, 2,500 people
killed. That would be American kills by
American
drone.
Kills, yeah.
Let's go to Tom in Owensboro, Kentucky. Tom, you're on the air. Thanks for calling.
Hi. I just wanted to ask two questions. And seeing the technologies there, and China's got drones, and was wondering whether or not satellite control has been employed yet, and with such things as U-2 planes, high altitude. The other question is about, the other question was concerning,
Tom will pick it up right there. Control, its sophistication, and who could potentially deploy drones. You cite the U.S., Russia, Israel. You say 40 more have them. How many countries have armed drones? How big a step is it to go from having a drone population to arming them up for lethal use?
Well, when we first did it, we thought it was going to be a big step. And it turned out to be relatively easy. So I would suspect that any country that has a drone program could probably arm it with existing technology. Satellites are part of it. Satellites are essential in the way we do it. And people have tried to hack into our satellite streams and take control of our drones. The Iranians say they've done that. In the novel, people tried to do that. In Bosnia, we had a U.S. drone that was flying overhead that people hacked their way into and picked up the feed, the video feed. And so the video feed from our drone was being played on television throughout Europe because the encryption wasn't being used that day. This is a program that can be attacked, and just as you can hack into anything else, you can hack into a drone program.
How do you read the politics of drone oversight in this country now, Richard Clark? You've been in the White House. You watch Washington. You know, Congress, there are some there who would like to limit the use of military drones by the United States. Even this release of the legal memorandum justifying attacks on Americans by drone is related here. Of course, that was written by a Harvard law professor who's now been put up for a judgeship in the U.S. Court of Appeals, First Circuit in Boston. This is David Barron. Senator Rand Paul, among others, has said he would slow that confirmation down if they didn't reveal exactly what the legal justification was. Do you see Congress stepping in to pare back American military drone use, or does this have a life of its own that Congress won't stop now?
It oddly enough, doesn't have much interest in the Congress unless you're talking about American drone use in the United States. Then all sorts of people get interested. But when you're talking about killing terrorists overseas, very few congressmen and senators are going to step up and say, oh, I want to criticize your program of killing terrorists. You know, the issue, I think, is a prior issue here, Tom, which is really, you know, do you want to kill terrorists? Do you want to get them before they get you, sort of thing? And if you do, is this a good way to do it? The Air Force will argue, and the White House will argue, this is a better way because it has lower collateral damage. You can take longer to look at the target. You can apply rules. You can have lawyers in the room making legal calls before you press the button. That's all true. But it's also true that we've killed a lot of innocent people, and despite all the rules and all the precautions. And there's a debate about how many innocent people we've killed. There are hugely different estimates. At one point, John Brennan, who was at the White House at the time, in my old job, said that we had killed no innocent people. Well, clearly, that's not true. Have we gotten to the point where we're using this so much, killing innocent people occasionally, that it turns support against us in countries like Yemen, in countries like Somalia, in countries like Pakistan?
Has a pattern been established by all of that drone use that this is now fair game as a military tool? The United States has used it, and so anybody else could too, and may use it more. Does it emerge as simply a standard tool of war and assassination?
Well, I think it would be very hard for the United States to criticize another government for doing it. If some country said, oh, there's a terrorist cell in this other country, and the other country won't go after them, and flew a drone over and attacked them, I think the United States would not be able to criticize that.
Let's go to New York, New Rochelle. George is calling. Hi, George. Thanks for calling. You're on the air.
I just wanted to ask, with these drones becoming cheaper and cheaper and basically going into fall into private hands if they're not already, which they probably are, what's going to prevent them, the owner of these drones, to just strap a bomb on and fly it into a nuclear plant? And how much, you know, radar can we pick up? And can it fly under radar? I mean, do we really want to turn these things loose to the private industries, you know, private people?
Strap on a bomb, fly it into a nuclear power plant. Richard Clark, what about the threat?
So the FBI has already arrested people in the United States in sting operations. One case where a guy was, I think a guy from Boston, was planning with the help of the FBI, that he obviously didn't know they were FBI, to get a commercial drone, a model plane kind of drone, strap some explosive on it and fly it into a window at the Pentagon. It doesn't take much imagination to think about lots of places where you could do that. And in the novel, that starts to take place.
So you don't really, you wouldn't have to have a very sophisticated, anything like a Predator-style sophistication drone to really do some damage.
Well, the commercially available drones now that you can strap a camera onto, you could strap a hand grenade onto. You wouldn't do a huge amount of damage, but you could kill somebody. And these drones that are available to the public are getting bigger and bigger. And someday soon, TV stations will have them to do traffic. Farmers will have them to look at crops. They already do. And as the drones get bigger, the payload that they can carry will get bigger. And I think it's just a matter of time until someone, the horror that the Secret Service has is the President of the United States is giving a speech in some open field, open stadium, outdoor venue. And suddenly the Secret Service looks up and there's a drone dive bombing the president. That's a new kind of threat.
In your novel, Richard Clark, Sting of the Drone, how do you have your antagonists here, organized crime, Al-Qaeda, thinking about getting their own hands on this kind of power?
Well, I don't want to reveal too much of the plot, but what we try to do in the novel is to let you see behind the curtain in the White House, in the kill committee, how that works. See behind the curtain in the pilots in Las Vegas, how that works. But also see it from the victim's point of view. See it from the innocent people perhaps bombed in Pakistan or Yemen. See it from the perspective of the terrorists. And what could they possibly do if they went after the program?
Do you have to have been in your position in the White House to set your imagination loose on that? Can you imagine others around the world with less background insight than you being able to think their way into that problem and do something lethal with it?
Well, I think a lot of people around the world are thinking about it. What I think is unique in this novel is a look, I will say it's a fictional look, but it's not too fictional, at the Kill Committee in the White House, and the process it goes through of making decisions about who to go after with drones, and the description of the U.S. drone program, I think is also fairly accurate.
Is it time for an international treaty that might put some kind of parameters around this use? I mean, you can imagine it just running amok. Should the U.S. be pushing on that front?
Well, the U.S. is probably the wrong person. We don't have a lot of credibility to do that. The United Nations has appointed a special rapporteur to report on and monitor U.S. drone use. And so it is a topic for discussion at the U.N. No nation has yet proposed a treaty. And I think if the United States did right now, we'd be laughed out of the room.
The U.S., which as you say, killed 2,500 people in five countries, you might be right. Richard Clark's new novel is Sting of the Drone. Richard Clark, thanks very much for being with us today. Terrific to have you.
Thank you, Tom.
Listeners, thanks for joining us. You can continue this conversation and get the On Point podcast at our website, onpointradio.org. Follow us on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. I'm at Tom Ashbrook, NPR, on Twitter. On Point is produced by Emily Alphen Johnson, Nick Anderson, Catherine Brewer, Julie Jopp, Sam Gale Rosen, Eileen Amata, Stefano Katsonis, James Ross, and Dean Russell. Our executive producer is Karen Schiffman. Thanks for joining us today. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
On Point is a production of WBUR Boston and NPR.